Hello, Utah, and welcome to the Fireside Chats with Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. My name is Vincent Carson, and I'm UCCD's Youth Program Director. These Fireside Chats are short conversations with Utah's citizen diplomats who are reformulating the American worldview by bringing their global, and in this case, orbital, experience back home to Utah. We hope that the embers of this conversation will light a fire in you and also make the global local. Today, I am excited to introduce Dr. Bonnie Baxter, director of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College. Thank you so much for joining us, Bonnie.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty, can you give me an overview of your work and your research?
Sure. So I came out of the field of my professional training was genetics and DNA repair and DNA damage. So I'm really a molecular biologist, but when I moved to Utah for a job, I wanted to do those things with microbes that live in Great Salt Lake because I got really interested in extremophiles and, these limits of life, like how salty can life be? How hot can life be? How cold can life be? So I wanted to apply my molecular biology skill set to something kind of cool and is something that would get my students excited. And so Great Salt Lake, it turns out, was really understudied and in this regard. And so everything my students do is novel and interesting. And that, because I'm interested in microbes that can stay inside salt over geologic time, and I'm interested in the way microbes push the limits of life, on our planet, that got me into, I segued my work into astrobiology, which is a rather, it's considered a new field, but really it started with the advent of NASA in 1958. They actually had a microbial genetics person working with them because they were concerned with bringing microbes home from the moon, for example. Folks have been thinking for a long time about what kind of life can survive in space. And is this the only place where where life has erupted on Earth? Is this the only place where that happens? And so those questions drive a lot of my research now.
So when thinking about Mars, I'm often brought to these depictions of the planet in science fiction. Right, even dating back 100 years ago, it was life on Mars was clearly in the public imagination with H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds, John Carter of Mars. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. It's fairly close. You can spot it in the night sky. And it's one of our closest neighbors. But I think that the perception of Mars that I have from science fiction might be a little wrong. Can you paint a picture of what Mars is like today?
Well, yeah, I can. I grew up during the Apollo space years, and one of my very first memories was the landing of Apollo 11. And so I grew up being fascinated by space, and my science ended up taking a really different tilt, but I've always had such an interest in it. So, and I do read a lot of sci-fi, so I appreciate that you mentioned that. Because I think there is some really good science in some sci-fi. Before I say today, let me take you back in time. Our solar system was a spinning disk, and the mass started pulling together as gravity worked on these objects, and the solar system then formed. And that was about 4.6 billion years ago, if you can imagine. Billion, not million. So 4.6 billion years ago, Mars and Earth formed at the same time. These rocky planets that are in close to the sun, that's typical of a solar system to have the less dense gas giants be out far and to have these rocky planets like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars to be in close. And so it was the case that Venus, Earth, and Mars were really similar early in the formation of our solar system. So Mars, we now know from all this incredible work with landers and rovers and orbiters, we now know that there was water on the surface of Mars There's really no scientific doubt. Anything that we, any place we looked on Earth, if we had evidence for a sedimentary rock, for example, we know how sedimentary rock forms on the Earth in water. And so we've taken that lens of what we know from Earth and applied it to these Martian geologist robots, these rovers. And so that's how we have all this incredible information. Mars is the only planet inhabited by robots, which I think is really kind of a fun bullet point. So what happened in Mars's history to make it different than Earth? And that's, it's really, that goes back 3.5 billion years ago. So for about a billion years, they look the same. And during that time, life erupts on Earth. We have our first evidence of life on Earth in stromatolites in rocks that are 3.5 billion years old. So we know life was on Earth, microbial life was on Earth at that time. It took complicated life a really long time to evolve after that. So if Mars looked the same and had the right chemistry, which it does, and had water, which it did, then there's no reason why life couldn't have also erupted there. Or we could have shared rocks back and forth. We do have more than 200 pieces of Mars that have been found on our planet in the form of meteorites from impacts. So that's kind of cool. So we could have shared life, or we could have erupted life twice in our solar system. So hold on to that, because then what happens is 3.5 billion years ago, the magnetic poles shift on Mars, and that causes a different interplay with the solar winds, and it lost its atmosphere. And it became a dead planet, no more volcanism, no more tectonics. And so all of the things that we know life needs on our planet disappeared on Mars. The surface water slowly evaporated, and the lakes now are like Bonneville salt flats. So today it's considered, you know, it's not very tectonically active. It's a desert. It's very dry. There's high radiation because there's very little atmosphere to protect from cosmic rays. So that was a long way to tell you about what Mars is like today, but I think it really frames the discussion about why we're interested in Mars.
Yeah. And so you mentioned this early life on Earth, stromatolites. Mm-hmm. These aren't like complex organisms. We're not expecting, if there are similar organisms that have fossilized and remain on Mars, we're not expecting dinosaur bones, right?
Right.
Can you describe what this life is like, what stromatolites are like?
Yes, I actually study them in Great Salt Lake. So we have the largest expanse of modern microbialites. I'll use that word. That's the parent term. Stromatolites are one subtype, and we do have some stromatolites, but we have some other types too. So we have these in Great Salt Lake in a modern environment where we can explore. And what we know is that cyanobacteria make these really sticky mats, and they do photosynthesis. And then that causes the calcium carbonate in the water to precipitate into little granules, and the sticky mat catches it. So it's literally biology and geology working together to build these rocks. So microbialite means rock, like meteorite, right? So it's literally a rock made by microbes. The purpose is to power an ecosystem. So we think that the oceans were lined with these microbialites, stromatolites et al, across the Earth. And that's what caused the great oxygenation event, which changed our atmosphere. So we think cyanos are really important in Earth's history. And because they've been around for so long, they have evolved to fit in all of our niches. I spoke recently with someone who runs the Polar Research Station in the Arctic. He's in Prague in Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic, but he studies polar cyanobacteria. So it makes sense that they would have evolved to all these different niches because they've been around for so long. So on Mars, we would expect to see these mats and these sticky mats leave leave little stripes in the rock record that you can see. So we're hoping that Perseverance, who's there now, can give us, shed some light on that, give us some information about such structures. And if we find some, we'll take a core sample and bring it home.
And Perseverance is the most recent Mars rover. It landed a month and a half ago.
Yep, in February.
In Jezero Crater, which is, from my understanding, a lake bed that used to have standing water. So you mentioned finding life in potentially in sediments on the surface of Mars. What would that look like? Like what would we expect it to look like today, 3.5 billion years after there was water?
I think there are three possibilities, and one is no fun at all. So I'm not going to talk about that one. That is that there's no life on Mars. And there never was. And so that's possibility one. And I just think that's less likely, frankly, than possibility two and three. So possibility two is that Mars had microbes swimming around in its water. Then the water dried up and the life is now stored in the minerals. And so it's existing still today. And I model this in salt. We dry microbes up and they get sequestered in these dry salt crystals. And we can resurrect them from salt that is hundreds of millions years old. Now, billions, that's a big ask, but 250 million year old salt, we've been able to get microbes out of them and bring them back to life. So that second possibility is that there's existing life on Mars, but it's hidden in the rocks. The third possibility is that there was life on Mars, but it died out because of the lack of water and the surface radiation, et cetera. And it left behind what we call biosignatures, like biology's molecules. And so when we bring these samples back from the Perseverance mission, and the ESA, European Space Agency, is collaborating with NASA on this second part of the mission, when those samples are returned to our planet, they're actually going to be dropped in Utah in the West Desert, which I think is fantastic. Those samples will look inside those salt crystals and minerals. NASA has a team of scientists who will examine them and look for the molecules of life or actual cells that are living. So those are the two possibilities I'm the most excited about.
So what I'm hearing is that you have plans to open a Mars Jurassic Park.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you said that we wouldn't find dinosaur bones on Mars, and that's absolutely right, because I told you things shifted about the time life is taking off on our planet. In the microbial world, things shift on Mars. And so Mars didn't have the conditions that we know we needed to develop complicated life. So if you apply what we know on Earth to Mars, we would say it's very unlikely that Mars would have had the geologic time to develop complicated life. So that's why we're looking for microbes.
And the Great Salt Lake has been compared to Jezero Crater in a number of ways. What makes the Great Salt Lake a potential analog for extraterrestrial lakes?
So since we have visitors from all over, I will tell you the story of the formation of Great Please. Salt Lake. It's in a basin. It's a terminal lake like the Dead Sea or Lake Urmia in Iran or the Aral Sea in Uzbekistan or Australian salt lakes. It's a terminal lake. So it's at the bottom of a bowl, essentially. And all of the water runs down into it from the watershed. And that's what they mean by there's no outlet to the ocean. That always confuses people. But really what it is, it's just kind of at the bottom of the bathtub. And so at this site over the last 800,000 years or so, there's been four big lakes, big freshwater lakes, but mostly it's looked like Great Salt Lake, this tiny salty puddle compared to, it's still a big lake, but compared to these big freshwater inland seas. And the last one of those was called Lake Bonneville. So the basin gets called after that, it's called the Bonneville Basin. And so that lake shrunk down and the freshwater as it evaporated after the last ice age, the water, the earth's warming up, the water's evaporating, it leaves behind the puddle in the bottom of the bathtub with all the salts concentrated. So that's why Great Salt Lake is salty, and these other terminal lakes are also salty. Mono Lake in California, Salt and Sea. There's dozens of them around the world. And those, they're typically salty, right? So as Mars lost surface water, the same thing would have happened. That's why this is such an interesting model to think about the last years of Jezero Crater's life. That lake would have evaporated. And as it did, it would have gotten saltier and saltier and saltier. And so if microbes were swimming around in that water, they would have evolved and learned to live with that amount of salt. So it is very scientifically plausible that the last life in aquatic environments on Mars, like lakes, was salty life. And so that's the connection to Great Salt Lake that I like to draw. And that's what got us working with NASA, is this is a Martian analog to think about how lakes dry up in closed basins like this.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned that Perseverance will take samples on Mars that hopefully will be returned by European Space Agency, ESA return mission. Can you talk about international collaboration in space exploration?
Yeah, I don't know everything, of course, but I think there could be people who could speak to that better than me. But I do know about the Mars missions and how interesting they are in terms of collaborations, because it takes a lot of money. And so if you have multiple governments working together and sharing data, that's super supportive. And that's where a lot of folks, I think, would like this to be, so that we're learning from each other. NASA makes all of their data available 6 months to the public, 6 months after it's accumulated. So the NASA scientists have like a 6 month window to process all their data, and then it gets released openly to the community. And every space agency doesn't do that, but I know some of them do, because it's important that the science move forward and that we collaborate. So if I back up for a minute, we go to Mars about every 2 years. Does anybody know why that is?
Because it takes so long to get them.
Well, that's a good point. But it's actually when the planets are close together.
When they're aligned. Okay. Yeah.
When their orbits bring them close enough that it's cheaper to send a mission.
Yeah.
It costs less fuel and less energy to get there. Is that what you were going to say, Vincent?
Yeah, and from my understanding, just in the past few months, the United States, the UAE, and China have sent That's missions correct. To orbit Mars.
Yep, and in the last window, India. So every 26 months is a window that we can send something to Mars. So the missions to Mars are always aligned with those launch dates in that every 26 months window. So we see action on Mars every couple of years. So this year was kind of a banner year, because we from the US sent Perseverance, which will be a collaboration ultimately with ESA. ESA will send a fetch rover in 2 years that will fetch all of the samples that Perseverance takes, put it in a rocket on its back, and launch it into orbit. And then we have some cowboy lasso orbiting spacecraft that will meet it and bring it back to Earth, which I think is really astounding. And the timeline on that is a little unclear, because it depends on funding. But I think the fetch rover is supposed to go in the next window. So that's an example of a really fabulous collaboration. And so then, of course, all of those countries should be collaborating on data. The UAE sent an orbiter. And the one from India a couple years ago is an orbiter. And its job, I remember the Indian one, it's called MOM, which I love. I'm trying to remember what that stands for, Mars Orbiter something, Mars Orbiter Mission, MOM. And they're collaborating a bit with NASA, but that is to look at some of the Martian moons, particularly Phobos is one of the ones that will be imaged by that. So each mission has like a slightly different purpose. The one from China is super exciting to me this year because it is an orbiter and a rover. So it's currently in orbit, and then in May, it's going to drop a rover to the surface, and we'll get another roving geologist who can tell us more about a different spot on Mars. Each rover has its own little place where it's working. So we still don't know all of the geology, all of Mars, but so that one also, I think, is kind of fun because there will be an orbiter that stays in orbit that communicates with the rover and sends data back and forth. So I think that could be fun.
Yeah, thank you very much for giving me the floor. So my question would be, what if we get a life on the Mars? What's the next step then? And like, is it going to be beneficial for us or is it going to be harmful? So we are just inviting the aliens to invade us, because once I heard that Stephen Hawking said it's not wise to look for the aliens because they might not be friend to us.
Or that's right.
We are just inviting the germs from the other planet.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Right. I think it's a super interesting question. And there are people working on what's called planetary protection. And there was a new NASA planetary protection statement that was put out this year that will govern the way some of this work is done. So this work will be done in chambers that will not be exposed to the air, for example, in sterile hoods and so forth. So there will be the ultimate precautions taken. However, as a person who studies microbes and the environment, I mean, there's nothing in Great Salt Lake that can live inside of me because it requires so much salt. So that's not where pathogens and diseases come from. They don't come from these environmental organisms. And I would find it hard to believe that extremophiles on Mars could be pathogens for humans, because as we're seeing with the coronavirus, viruses and bacteria, microbes, they evolve with their host to cause disease. And so what we know about pathogenesis, and I'm not in the health field, so that's not really my backdrop. What we know is that the microbe would have had to have evolved with a host in order to have the mechanisms to enter the host cells. So I think we're pretty safe bringing something back from Mars because people haven't been there. So we don't have that host. Now, the reason we're being careful, though, is that microorganisms have a really short cell division. I mean, humans have like a 20-year reproductive cycle, but E. coli has a 20-minute reproductive cycle. So that's really different. You can evolve very quickly when you're a microbe because you're making babies like every 20 minutes, right? So evolution happens on a speeded up scale. So I think that's why we want to be careful. The other thing is we don't know if there is life on Mars, we don't know if it will look like our life. We don't know if it will be DNA based. All of the life on our planet, 100% of the life on our planet is related to a single common ancestor. And we know that because all of us, slime molds and humans and giraffes, all of us use DNA as our genetic material. All of us have the same genetic code. So a certain code in your DNA that gets converted to RNA, that gets converted to protein, that works exactly the same in every organism on our planet. All of our life forms have ribosomes to make proteins. All of our life forms have these common organisms or these common features. And so we know that all life on Earth is one event. One event of life erupting. There may have been, let's say there were 10,000 events of life erupting on our planet. Maybe this is the only one that went forward, so that everything in modern life on Earth looks the same in terms of its basic chemical principles. So we don't know if there was a different life form on Earth, but the first question when you said, what's the next step? Mashref said, what's the next step when we get these samples back? If we find life, what happens next? The first question I would want to ask is, what is the essence of that life? What is this genetic material? Does it look like Earth, or does it not look like Earth? Because there is this idea of panspermia, and it sounds a little sci-fi, but there's a lot of evidence to support it. So that means sperm means seed and pan means global. So what that panspermia theory means is that microbes erupted on one space body and then were transferred to another space body. So if we find that Martian life is there and it is a DNA-based life and it looks a lot like Earth life, then we're going to ask the question like, well, is this one eruption of life and it got transferred from Mars to Earth or from Earth to Mars? That will be a really important question, because that gets at the question of, you know, if life erupted twice in our solar system, how many times in the billions of galaxies, in the billions of solar system, in the billions of galaxies could this have happened? So is Earth rare, or is this a really common occurrence? And the planet's conditions will just decide how far that life goes. So that doesn't mean intelligent life is everywhere in the universe, but it certainly would give us more data to suggest, you know, microbial life could be elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very plausible, yep. But we have no idea, have we, whether life erupted once or 1,000 times on Earth. We have no idea whether it's likely to happen anywhere else. I mean, it's entirely speculation. And I mean, it'd be nice to think there is life somewhere else, providing it's not too malevolent. But I mean, in terms of co-evolution and so forth, I mean, we've got ash dieback at the moment. I mean, the ash dieback problem is not a problem in its original country. It's only a problem in Europe and America, because the life forms in America and Europe haven't evolved to cope with it. So, I mean, any of these microbes could be, if not dangerously alive, they could be toxic, couldn't they?
Sure, sure.
It's different.
Yeah, they could have toxins. So I want to go back to the very first thing you said, which is, you know, it's plausible, but maybe, you know, the data to support it's a little sketchy because we don't have evidence of life on another planet yet. But I will say that you can look at the body of data, and this is why we're excited about it now. You can say, okay, there are meteorites on Earth, and the little gas pockets inside, the little vacuoles inside those meteorites, when we probe that and we ask what does that gas look like, matches the Martian atmosphere. We also have pieces of the moon, and you can do the same experiment and you can match it to what's been measured on the moon. So with a great deal of certainty, we think we have, you know, pieces of Mars on our planet. And these were from early collisions, right? So an asteroid hits Mars and pieces of Mars fly off and we're close by, so we gather. And there's no reason why that couldn't have happened in the other direction. There are two British scientists, Francis Crick of DNA fame and Leslie Orgel, who studied RNA. Those folks put out a paper in the 1970s suggesting panspermium was a possibility. I think when you win a Nobel Prize, you can kind of have wacky ideas, you know? And when I go back to that paper now, they were right on. They were thinking in really concrete terms, like, what do we have evidence of? So one of the pieces of evidence, for example, is that microbes can be exposed to space conditions and survive. A number of scientists in my field of extremophiles have put together missions that have gone to the International Space Station, and they've exposed these microbes to space conditions for 2 weeks, and then they bring them home. And it turns out the halophiles, the salt lovers that I study, they survive just fine. And it also turns out that the spore formers, the microbes that get encysted in little protective seed coats, those survive just fine. Now, the spore formers we know, you mentioned toxins, Clostridium and Bacillus. Clostridium botulinum makes botulism toxin. Bacillus anthracis makes anthrax toxin. So you're absolutely right. There can be toxins in microbes that don't have to do with that microbe being pathogenic. And those are spore formers, so they're really hard to get rid of. So the reason people get botulism is that food has to essentially be UV irradiated or treated to autoclaves, or, you know, in order to get rid of that microbe, because the spore protects it. So what we know from studying spore formers is they probably could ride on a rock through our atmosphere and survive. And so that's a piece of evidence that it's not evidence for life on another planet, but it's evidence that supports this as a plausible idea.
Hello from Scotland.
Oh, hello. My people are from Scotland.
Really? Okay. Actually, mine aren't. But anyway, when you mentioned that any possible life might not be DNA based, that kind of blew my question out of the water, or yeah, out of the salty basin. And so I had another question, and I had been wondering if it might be something like an archaea, the halophiles, yeah, you're talking about, something very old, archaea like this in the salt rock.
Yes.
And then when you mentioned about needing the requirement for rock, is that because we're thinking about origins being dependent on ion gradients, thinking about thermal vents, is that the necessity for rock?
Yeah, oh, that's an excellent, those are all really excellent questions. So we know that life erupted on Earth before photosynthesis happened. So if you look around you, if you look out your window and you see all these life forms out there, almost everything you see and think about has a trophic pyramid, and the bottom of that is some photosynthesis, some primary producer. But we do have some places on our planet where that's not the case. I have colleagues that work in Oman, down in deep oil wells, where there's no access to light, and there is an energy metabolism that isn't based on photosynthesis. And so in that type of rock where cells are using hydrogen, for example, we think that looks a lot like early Earth. And when you mentioned thermal vents have that kind of chemistry that is pre-photosynthesis. They have all the right ingredients, and they have heat, which is, you need some kind of spark, right? At least we think we do. So there are some places on our planet where we can look and we can think about origins and what that might have been. And then we can apply that to Titan or Enceladus or some of these other places in our solar system. So it's not just Mars that people are thinking about. I have another colleague that works on subglacial, like microbes in cores underneath glaciers. And that looks a lot like what we would expect to see on Saturn's moon Titan, for example. So, so when you analyze how are the microbes, like what's their paycheck look like, right? What's their currency? How are they living and making a living? Those give us some really solid answers about the ability of microbes to do novel, interesting things that are outside of what we have considered normal and what we begin to frame as the way a trophic system works. So I think those studies give us a lot of cool information. If I had to guess, nucleotides are so good that make up DNA and RNA. They are so good at doing what they do because they can hold information, but they also can be enzymatic. For example, in RNA, it can be an enzyme. So it's hard to imagine that life would evolve without that. And so you have to really push your brain. And some of this work in arsenic, for example, could, you look at the periodic table, could the element right underneath phosphorus make a backbone in DNA? And that would be arsenic. And when people do those experiments, they don't, those arsenate bonds don't hold together really well. So like you can do experiments to try different substitutions and nothing quite works like, you know, millions, billions of years of evolution, right? So Mother Nature's got some tricks.
That's such a fantastic question. Thank you so much, Dr. Baxter. And thank you to everyone who came, especially our out of country folks. This is, I think, a first for us. Awesome.
Thank you so much, everyone. I appreciate your attention and your questions. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you all.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
These Fireside Chats are brought to you by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. Special thanks to Dr. Bonnie Baxter, our guest speaker, Westminster College as our continuous partner, our executive director, Felicia Maxfield Barrett, and I'm your guest host, Vincent Carson. I'll see you on the next episode of Fireside Chats.